Because of listeners like you, Preborn has helped to rescue over 67,000 babies. Your $28 to sponsor one ultrasound doubled a baby's chance at life. Your tax-deductible gift saves lives. Please join us in this mission. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. Good morning. It is Wednesday, June 25th, and the Congress is pushing hard this weekend on the One Big Beautiful Bill. And so this coming from Axios this morning, Senate Majority Leader John Thune expects to start voting Friday on President Trump's One Big Beautiful Bill, he told Axios in an exclusive interview on Tuesday. So Thune is confident Congress will meet its self-imposed July 4th deadline to get the bill on President Trump's desk. So Thune huddled with House Speaker Mike Johnson around midday on Tuesday. Minutes before that meeting, Thune also said he hadn't chatted with Johnson recently about the bill, saying, quote, "We've kind of had our noses to the grindstone." Thune also said last week he was looking likely for initial vote on Thursday, setting up for a potential weekend working on this. Meanwhile, Speaker Mike Johnson's office has issued a statement saying from Speaker Johnson saying, quote, "While congressional Democrats feign concern about the safety and well-being of U.S. service members, House Republicans are working to deliver legislation that actually accomplishes that and supports them. Amid this global threat landscape, there's never been a better time for a piece of legislation, a once-in-a-generation opportunity like the One Big Beautiful Bill. It's a generational investment in American military might, and we need to get it to President Trump's desk as soon as possible." So for more on this, joining me now is Congressman Addison McDowell from the great state of North Carolina. Good morning, Representative. And overall, what's the status of the One Big Beautiful Bill?
Well, good morning, Jenna, and thanks so much for having me on. I think that the status is we're in a great spot. And I just want to highlight the fact that this is a pro-growth, pro-worker, pro-business, pro-family, and pro-America bill. That is what Republicans are voting for, and the Democrats are only focused on impeaching the President of the United States for what I don't know. But, you know, this bill, it's about two things. It is about taxes, and it is about the border. And we need to keep in mind that when Democrats vote against the One Big Beautiful Bill, they're voting to increase your taxes. That's what I want the American people and my constituents to understand, is that when we pass this historic legislation and President Trump signs it into law, Republicans and President Trump, we are keeping the promises that we made, and I'm proud of that, and I'm going to be proud to support this bill as it continues through the process.
Yeah, and I think it is important with all of the pieces and the components of this bill. There's been a lot of chatter, I think, and some back and forth between some concerns about what's in it, but a lot of focus of what's really good in it as well. And so, you know, when you mention the Trump tax cut and making that permanent, what specifically is that actually accomplishing that will affect Americans' lives every day?
Well, yeah. So, I mean, it prevents the single largest tax increase in the history of our country. It would mean the average American would pay $40,000, or it'd be a 40% tax increase. This bill will literally put more money in their pocket because it prevents their taxes from going through the roof. And so, you know, this is a giant step, but it's more of a course correction, because, you know, we see all of this wasteful spending. And so this is, you know, this bill does a lot of things, including cutting taxpayer money from these woke NGOs, and this is a course correction, because no more is America going to fund woke foreign programs and waste Americans' tax dollars. This bill is a giant step towards rooting out that waste, fraud, and abuse. But you know, every Democrat that votes against this, they are voting for a 40% tax increase on Americans, and that just blows my mind.
And I'm speaking with Representative Addison McDowell and about the One Big Beautiful Bill. And speaking of ending waste and cutting this excessive spending from these NGOs, one of the things that AFA Action in particular has highlighted on our social media over the last few days is that the One Big Beautiful Bill also delivers a major pro-life win, that abortion providers will no longer be eligible for Medicaid funds. That's really significant, I think, to the pro-life community.
Absolutely. You're exactly right. And I'm so proud of our leadership, and especially the speaker on, you know, look, I'll say this about Speaker Johnson. He is the one word I would use to describe his leadership is unexplainable, but it's unexplainable to your average person or your average onlooker because he is a man of great faith. And it's the prayer that goes into this on his end that you know, look, I'm a believer, and I believe that it's important that we keep our promises, and this is a promise we've been making for a long time. But I'm so proud of all of the prayer that went into this bill and went into this process, because we're getting wins like this, and we're literally saving lives. The Democrats, you know, they're lying when they say that we're literally killing people. No, in fact, it's the opposite. We're literally saving the unborn who you have so recklessly and shamefully been killing for so long.
And that's a really important component, and I think especially for our American Family Radio Network audience, it's incredibly encouraging to hear how much prayer has gone into this and how many Christians and believers are part of this process, including Mike Johnson, you know, who listeners know I've known personally for years. I know he's a man of very deep and sincere faith, and there are many members of Congress, thankfully, that are also praying alongside him. You included, Representative McDowell, and how important for believers is it for us to understand how praying for our leaders through this process not only encourages you, but really, I believe, affects the outcome?
Oh, well, absolutely. Well, we don't believe in luck. And by we, I mean Christians. We don't believe in luck. We believe in God's providence. And he is, you know, more important than all of us. But I'll put it to you this way. I spoke at a Trump rally right before the election, and I had to follow Franklin Graham, Billy Graham's son, which was a really tall task. And when he walked off stage, I just said, you know, great job, Reverend Graham. And he said, do you know the only person that can change the outcome of a vote? I was like, who's that? And he's like, our Father. And, you know, it's important to remember that prayer literally does amazing things. It does miracles, and it changes the outcome because when we talk, the Lord's listening. And so it is so important that we are constantly in prayer. All of these victories that we've accomplished, you know, the secret sauce or the hidden ingredient that I'm so glad that the American people are getting to see, because I hope that the unexplainable nature of what we're able to accomplish when everyone is telling us we can't do it is we're doing it through prayer. And we're doing it through a reliance on the Holy Spirit that he's going to move. And so far he has.
And that's incredible. And again, just, I think, very encouraging to know that, especially amid all of the politics and the news cycle. And I think a lot of regular everyday Americans aren't really sure what to believe and who they can trust in Washington. And so when we're looking at something like the One Big Beautiful Bill and this type of legislation, I think it's really important to understand why Christians specifically are supporting this and why Christians who are conservatives and your worldview dictates your policy, all of those things are behind this type of bill. So what would you say to your colleagues, whether it's fellow Republicans, hopefully minimal, or people on across the aisle who object to this, why specifically Christians are advancing this legislation beyond, you know, of course, what we've talked about with the pro-life wins? That's a significant thing, making tax cuts permanent. But why this fits into a biblical model of government?
Well, yeah, I mean, I would say that that could be pretty obvious. I mean, obviously the pro-life issue is an obvious one, and we want to help people that need it. I mean, that this some of the cuts that we're making are to make sure that these programs that go to people that need them work better for the people that actually need them. And that's what we want to do. Look, I've said for a long time that if the church functioned like it should, there'd be no need for government. But, you know, we have at least my colleagues on the other side of the aisle, some of them, this is their religion. And so they look at this from a completely different lens and a completely different worldview than we do. And I look at this through the worldview of, I'm a believer. I believe that Christ is my Savior and died for my sins. And I don't look at this bill or anything bigger than Him. And I think that just completely changes the way that you approach this. When your job as a congressman or congresswoman, that's your religion. For me, that's not the case. And for a lot of my colleagues on the Republican side, that's not the case. We look at it through a completely different lens. I think that's where so many of these fights and these battles that can get ugly, that's where they come from, is that the worldview is just completely different.
It's so true. And this is what's so important to select and prefer Christians as our leaders, as our first Supreme Court Chief Justice John Jay very wisely said over 200 years ago. And it's incredibly important to understand the worldview of our leaders. And even something, one of the other things we haven't even mentioned yet, Congressman Addison McDowell, in this bill is the funding for border enforcement. And of course, that comes from a biblical worldview of sovereign nations, of protecting our borders. And Trump's plan for this is a very good thing for America. And that's incredibly important because funding ICE, funding Department of Homeland Security, that's really important as well.
100%. I mean, the number one reason I came to Congress was because I lost my little brother Luke to a fentanyl poisoning when he was 20 years old. It was 2016. And that's the number one reason I'm here, is to make a difference on the border. And so I'm so proud of what this bill does. One of the things that's talked about a little less, though, is the money that is going to the Coast Guard. Because when you think about it, if we secure our southern and our northern border, these, you know, billion-dollar industries of drug and human trafficking, they're not just going to stop. They're going to come from our coast. And we've already seen that begin to take place. I mean, you've got the Coast Guard arresting boats full of folks that want to do our country harm through any means. And so I'm so grateful for that because, you know, I represent a landlocked district, and I'm talking to you about the Coast Guard. But I'm talking to you about the Coast Guard because I'm so excited by the fact that this bill provides funding for the Coast Guard so that fentanyl that would otherwise come in through our ports won't make it to my district. And that will save people, and it will prevent moms and dads like mine from having to get the message that, you know, ma'am or sir, your son or daughter is dead. And that is a huge victory, and I'm so grateful for that.
Thank you for sharing your story. I'm so sorry for your and your family's loss. And these are things that directly hit home. And, you know, whether it's protecting Americans from, you know, violent crimes or from the fentanyl that the president has been saying is coming in just insane amounts across the border, or just protecting our election integrity and security from, you know, people who aren't eligible to vote. I mean, all of these things come into this. And so in just the last minute or so I have with you, Congressman, and thank you so much for coming today. How can people pray for you and for Congress on this specifically?
Yeah. Well, I would say specifically for me, I'm not expecting anybody to feel bad for me, right? You know, I volunteered to do this, and that is what it is. But I felt called to do this, and you know, I believe that the Lord is going to honor that. And the hardest part of my job is that I have to leave my wife and my two kids at home and come up here for 3, 4, or 5 days a week. That's the hardest part, and I believe that we're doing what the Lord called us to do as a family. But it doesn't make saying goodbye to my 2 and 2-year-old and 8-month-old any easier. And so pray for me that, you know, as I'm up here serving my country, my constituents, and my faith, that the Lord would bless that, He would honor it, and that you know, my family would be safe and happy. And I asked for prayer for that. But I think for us as members of Congress, just praying for clear minds and clear hearts so that we can do what we were sent here to do.
Amen. Well, Representative Addison McDowell, we will be praying for you. Thank you so much for your service, and we will be right back with more. This June 24th marks 3 years since Roe v. Wade was overturned. But here's what you may not know. Abortion numbers have surged to a 10-year high. The battleground has shifted from the courtroom to our homes. Today, over 60% of abortions happen through the abortion pill, taken in silence and often alone. Preborn Network clinics are standing in the gap, meeting women in their most desperate hour. And here's what they're seeing. Young mothers, terrified and misled, are delivering their babies, tiny, perfectly formed, onto bathroom floors. These precious babies, once called just tissue, now are lifeless. 11% of these women who take the abortion pill will suffer serious health complications. Countless others carry emotional scars for a lifetime. When you give to Preborn, you're not just saving a baby, you're saving a mother as well. You're giving her hope, financial support, and the truth. Preborn has already rescued over 350,000 babies, but there are so many more who need our help. Your tax-deductible gift makes this mission possible. To donate now, dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby, or go to preborn.com/AFR. That's preborn.com/AFR.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. Well, amid all of the action in Iran and the discussion among conservatives and Americans overall on the president's decisions and the ongoing conflict between Iran and Israel as the ceasefire has basically fallen through, Rasmussen reports the daily presidential tracking poll as of yesterday shows that 52% of likely U.S. voters approve of President Trump's job performance overall, 47% disapprove. The latest figures include 36% who strongly approve of the job Trump is doing and 39% who strongly disapprove. And this also coming as most voters, according to Rasmussen as well, oppose sending U.S. ground troops. And so the latest Rasmussen Reports national telephone and online survey finds that 48% of likely U.S. voters support the United States using its Air Force to support Israel in the war against Iran, including 28 who strongly support such action. 40% are opposed to using the U.S. Air Force against Iran, including 25% who strongly oppose it. And interestingly, 11% are not sure. So joining me now to discuss all this and more is Mark Mitchell, who is the CEO of Rasmussen Reports. And Mark, this is just always really fascinating data to kind of see, you know, what the American people are thinking. And of course, President Trump pays a very, very close attention, I know personally, to all of the polls. So what does this data suggest about America's posture and ongoing with the Iran situation?
Yeah, great to be back, Jenna. And I can tell you, managing to the polls gets a bad name, but that's actually probably what should happen in a representative democracy. And I know for a fact that the Trump administration has been looking at these because we've seen it coming and we've asked a whole bunch of questions about this situation over there. And it is complex, but it's pretty clear based on what's happened so far that I don't think any of this is really going to be a problem. 84% at least somewhat agreed that Iran can never have a nuke. And about 2 weeks ago, we asked the question, would you support an airstrike on the nuclear facility? That was a strong majority, I think 57. And even the number you just quoted, 48% Navy being used, it has the keyword, tricky phrase in there, of war. And so even when you put war in the question, if it's phrased as supporting Israel and against Iran to go after the nuclear facilities, Americans are pretty supportive of it. What they're not supportive of is boots on the ground. That's only 14% strong approve and 33% at least somewhat approve.
And that's interesting. So what have you gone in more in depth in terms of the questioning of why specifically, you know, boots on the ground, more Americans oppose versus just the type of engagement we've already seen from the administration?
You know, it's hard to put words in their mouth. At a certain point, when you make the questions longer and more specific, you're just getting back what you want to get back. But I think what we saw recently with Ukraine and Russia is Americans understanding, again, what happens with complicated foreign entanglements. Because when it started, supporting Ukraine against Russia was actually really popular, and people thought Ukraine was going to win. People thought America wasn't doing enough. And over the 2 years we started asking that question, it got to where nobody thought Russia or Ukraine was winning. Over a majority thought it was a stalemate, and a plurality of people said we were doing too much as opposed to not enough to help Ukraine. So I think that still burns bright in people's minds, but also you got to acknowledge that for decades, this Iran nuclear, basically, it's been a talking point. And that's not to dismiss the risk here, but Americans, that works. Those things are effective. And I think you also have to admit that Americans have been somewhat desensitized to taking unilateral action against threats to the United States over the last couple of presidencies.
And I'm speaking with Mark Mitchell, who's the CEO of Rasmussen Reports. And, you know, you mentioned earlier this term war, and I was speaking on this program yesterday about the constitutionality of all of this and the difference between a declaration of war versus a temporary preventative strike. And I think that this term war, you know, not to be all Clinton and say, you know, well, it depends on what the definition of is, but that's right. Kind of, you know, what we're facing in terms of a definition, which can be a little bit fuzzy, of what war means to the average person who's responding to these polls. So how important do you think the terminology is, and in the mind of, you know, of some of these people that that you're speaking to, and how even you phrase the questions, how important is it for the Trump administration to be very precise in their messaging around this to help conservatives who genuinely would support this understand what's actually going on?
Right. Well, it's tough to say, because what we really see is that there's just so much data and noise and competing ideas, and it all just sort of gets to the normies through osmosis. And that's the challenge, because you never really know what sticks. You never really know when somebody's going to do something that destroys their political capital or comes out and does something super popular. But Trump has been really great at this. And I think a lot of people were trepidatious, as I was, and I can explain why. But going into this, Trump's an intuitive leader. He makes snap decisions. Sometimes it seems chaotic, but I think he's earned people's trust. And what you saw was things like him launching trial balloons, like that tweet about regime change that Carolyn Leavitt sort of walked back. But then also after the strike, immediately coming out and being very strong that, like, nope, we're done. It's completed. Mission accomplished. And then calling out Israel for overstepping potentially the ceasefire agreement. So his branding, I think that's all stuff that people was geared to get to the voters. And also, again, what we haven't seen at all is his approval rating change. And so he's earned his trust. I think people know who he is. He's been through situations like this before. And quite frankly, with how popular getting rid of Iranian nukes was, he should get a bounce out of this, to be honest with you, assuming that the line gets drawn here. But I think he's got, you know, I think we look, it took 2 years for opinion to change on the Ukrainian war. And in this case, he was elected for his domestic policy agenda. I know he's going to get back to that. And that's where his numbers are off the chart.
Yeah. And speaking of the domestic policy agenda, interestingly as well, from Rasmussen, 47% approve of so-called sanctuary states. So nearly half of the voters, according to this poll or survey, nearly half of voters favor the policy of so-called sanctuary states, which restrict state and local officials from cooperating with federal immigration authorities. I find that just so insane, frankly, that nearly half of Americans would be okay with this. Where do you see that in the broader picture? Yeah.
Well, so this, I think, underscores an incredibly important point that I think our republic needs to wrestle with going forward, and that's the realities of the Overton window. And so where we're at is that mass deportations is overwhelmingly positive, but at the same time, a plurality of voters actually support sanctuary policies. Now, a lot of it comes down to the way the wording of the question went. But this has been an actual reality, and people might think America is most against sanctuary cities policies than ever. And that's not true, because ubiquitously every Democrat politician has normalized them. And so the Overton window inexorably shifts left, when at the same time there's really nothing, like nothing at all, in an organized way where money's being spent and people are working on it, or there's coordination to move the Overton window back right. And that's a major problem.
Yeah. And how is that going to factor in your view, from what you've seen in these pullings into the midterms?
Well, that's tough. There's a lot of black swans that could happen between now and the midterms. I think the biggest would probably be the economy. Although I will say now that we did a generic ballot. Democrats are up one. I think it was noisy. We're probably looking at a Republican plus one, Republican plus two kind of situation, all things being equal. But right direction is super high right now. Republicans are picking up new registrations. And if everything stays the same, it'll probably be a close race with maybe some Republican pickups, maybe not. You know, it all comes down a lot to the counting. I think it's too soon to tell what turnout's going to be like for these Senate races. And we'll be actually polling a lot of those. But I've been worried about all these other confounders, like what happens now that there's potentially a federal investigation into Act Blue. How does that affect the race? Are the Democrats going to have the same kind of funding advantage that they always do, because they seem to have a hard time fundraising right now? And they're out there literally campaigning for national office like Newsom on 10-20% positions, and it's hurting their numbers. So I don't know how they think that's going to be successful for them. It seems they're more interested in resisting than actually putting together a plausible opposition to the MAGA agenda.
And so how does this 47% approval compare with past surveys on sanctuary cities or overall the Trump border policy? Is this rising or falling or kind of remaining the same?
Well, I think it across the board shows key problems with Democrats and their agenda. If you looked 10 to 15 years ago and asked this question, you probably would have seen, you know, 20-30%, and I can rattle off a massive list. Late-term abortions, reparations, just all those kinds of things, defunding the police. And we don't have numbers on all of it, but the trend has been that Democrats are more and more supportive of this. I think the last time we checked, we had a majority of Democrats supported slavery reparations. And so the left is getting crazier, but also smaller. And that's good, but it also presents its own problems, because the level of political rhetoric around violence has been increasing. Their willingness to disregard laws has been increasing. And it's along with that, all these other indicators that we've pulled on have been shooting up. Like, we had 43% of Americans thought a civil war was going to be likely in the next couple of years. That doesn't come from nowhere. I mean, that's a major issue.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm speaking with Mark Mitchell, who's the CEO of Rasmussen Reports. And, you know, this is interesting data as well, especially as we're seeing the about $20 million that the Democrats are putting into trying to message to young men. And so were there notable demographic splits like age, geography, education, you know, some of these things among those who support these type of Democrat policies?
Well, so over the last 10 years or so, we've seen mega trends, which is that white voters are getting less conservative, driven by older white voters and women liberals and suburban, that kind of thing, right? And yet at the same time, 18 to 39-year-olds, Hispanic voters, black voters have been getting more conservative. And it's really tough to track because, you know, these exit polls, I don't trust them. I don't really trust any mainstream media pollsters at all. And what we've seen is astounding records where black approval, depending on the day, is between 30-50%, where Hispanic voters pull to the right of white voters, especially on immigration issues. So these are all these big mega trends. But then the question is, okay, like the leading edge, because the Democrats have always had such an advantage with the young voters, and what does that look like? And my polls are a little different than others. I still show 18 to 29-year-olds not the most conservative, but the second most conservative age bracket. behind 30 to 39-year-olds, that's where the real rift is. And what's wild is how different men and women are in our polls in that age bracket. 30 to 39-year-old women are 35 points left than the men. And that's a challenge because these people are supposed to be, you know, in their professional prime, buying houses, building families, procreating, mm-hmm. indoctrinating their children into the right, you know, set of values. And instead, it's like, is this an extinction-level event? I don't know. But how does a society grapple with that kind of rift?
Yeah. And do you find that among those women, do you have any data on whether they're married, single, children or not?
Believe it or not, those demographic factors alone don't really describe as much signal as just gender in the age bracket. 18 to 29-year-old men and women were 20 points apart. The 30 to 39-year-olds were 35 points apart. But when I try and break them down into the other demographics, the differences aren't as much. We've had other signals, though, that sort of describe what's going on. So religion is a super big one. That's almost as big of a signal as party and ideology. In religion, we had atheists going over 70 points to Kamala Harris, whereas evangelical Christians were going 35 points Trump. And then there's always like interesting, weird ones. Like there's always been an income and education signal, and those aren't as big, but I bet you they would be if we layered in race. But then one weird one is that we had in one poll pet ownership, and we looked at, marital status, gender, and pet ownership. And it really is true, the single women cat owners are most left-leaning, like by a massive amount, almost 40 points going to Kamala Harris, when married women dog owners were 15 points Trump. I mean, it's kind of funny, but the trope is actually true. Like, we proved it.
See, cats are evil. I'm just telling you, like that's we've proved that hypothesis. And so my two dogs who are laying at my feet and are very conservative, Todd and Copper, as my audience knows, they're loving nice. This data, Mark. But in light of this last question for you, so in light of all of this, then, you know, we know the Democrats are focusing on young men, whether they'll be successful in that, you know, I guess remains to be seen. And worldview. It absolutely indicates policy. So for the church, we need to be focused on, you know, winning people to the worldview, because then the politics will naturally follow. But, you know, so the church has its focus. But for the Republican Party overall and conservatives, where should the $20 million investment or, you know, whatever the number would be on the Republican side in light of this, where do you see the most opportunities for growth in the next year?
Well, the Republicans need to put, in my opinion, a lot more money to work institutionalizing the values that they want in their party. I've been down to D.C. and walked along Capitol Hill. There's really no form or function, any way to get real principles working across what everybody does there. Maybe that's not the way a representative democracy is supposed to work. They're supposed to represent their constituencies. But it is what's happening on the left. And I do think the left has a crisis of authenticity that they're not going to be able to solve by papering it over with dollars. They basically, in order to consolidate power, I don't use this term derogatory, but they have feminized logic. They've created an alternate reality, an alternate set of quasi-facts that are very actually like religious. And it's a powerful religion. It is very effective at purifying itself and, you know, indoctrinating new people, but it's not indoctrinating people that dabble in objective facts. And so the Republicans, the conservatives, principled people have the high ground here. They have truth literally on their side, but they are being outclassed across the board in electioneering, thought leadership, messaging. And there is just a massive vacuum that is not being filled that could somehow, and I don't know what that looks like.
Well, that's a great problem that we need to solve as conservatives. And, you know, as my pastor was just talking about in the context of evangelism, this Sunday, and I think the same thing could be said for politicking, frankly, is that we have to have a strategy. It's not just that truth is on our side and we just go out and assume that, you know, when everybody hears it, suddenly they'll wake up and go, oh yeah, that just totally makes sense. You actually have to have strategy behind it and understand what connects with people, and conservatives really need to do that better. But that's such a great conversation. We'll have to pick that up another time very soon. Mark Mitchell, really appreciate having you on. As always, CEO of Rasmussen Reports. You can follow them on X, and we will be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
The month of June has been hijacked by the anti-Christian culture to show their pride in something God calls an abomination. When you support AFR, you help us continue to stand for godly values and provide the resources for you to stay in the know about the enemy's tactics. To say thank you for your gift this month, we'll give you the booklet, Inside the LGBTQ Push of the 1990s, to help strengthen your convictions. Just go to afr.net/offers. afr.net/offers.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. And in case you missed it, Andrew Cuomo in New York has conceded his electoral mayor, a New York City mayor race, meaning that a 33-year-old former rapper and very current socialist will win the New York City Democrat primary. So this is Zoran Mamdani, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, and he has a controversial past, including a time where he allegedly voiced his love for leaders of a nonprofit convicted of funneling $12 million to Hamas. So New York City just is not choosing wisely, at least among the Democrats, but that happened yesterday. And for more on that, you can follow Colin Rugg, who has been posting some really good videos of this 33-year-old state rep, and you can find him at Colin, C-O-L-L-I-N, Rugg, R-U-G-G, on X. And meanwhile, we need to also be considering the brutal persecution of Iranian Christians in the midst of all of this conflict in the Middle East. And so according to persecution.org and many other websites and data points, including Open Doors International, Iran's repressive regime has executed more than 900 people in 2024. That is as of about April of this year, and handed down scores of death sentences for religious-based charges, according to a March report by the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom. And so research by a UK-based nonprofit found that Iranian courts sentenced 96 Christians to a combined 263 years in prison last year. And these troubling statistics represent a 38% increase in average sentence length and a sixfold increase in cumulative sentencing compared to the previous year in 2023. So several Christians received particularly severe sentences of 10 years or more, according to that report that was published. And in addition to the increased judicial repression of religion, Iran also stepped up its street-level enforcement of morality laws, mainly targeting women and girls seen as violating the country's strict religious regulations on dress. So let's bring in a good friend, Tom Askell, who's the president of Founders Ministries, also a pastor here in my home state of Florida. And Tom, I think, you know, in the midst of all of the news of the day and looking at, you know, the Iran nuclear capabilities and all of this, sometimes we forget to also focus on, you know, what's going on in the civil society, particularly for Christians in the Middle East. So good morning. And, you know, what should we be focused on here?
Yeah. Good morning, Jenna. And thank you for inviting me on again. It's always good to be with you. We should never forget those who are in chains, as the scriptures tells us to do, as if we were enchained with them. And just yesterday, I got an email from a man that we support who is actually has planted a church in Iran, in an out line area, and was talking about some of the difficulties that they are facing there. They've seen believers, people come to Christ over the last few years, but as a result of those strikes and retaliatory strikes and difficulties that have arisen within the nation there, he said they're facing some real serious issues. Some of their members are facing serious challenges, and with regard to their standing in the society there and trying to travel. Some of them have travel plans that have to be canceled because now visa issues are difficult. We've got a new seminary we just started, Founders Seminary. One of our students is from a country in the Middle East, and he just contacted us and said, I'm not going to be able to take these classes because my visa is up in the air, and I won't know the disposition of it until long after classes have started next month. So these are real-life concerns that we should not lose sight of as we're talking about geopolitical challenges, and all of us are concerned about that as well. But God's people exist throughout the world. Christians exist throughout the world. There are Christians in Israel. There are Christians in Iran. There are Christians in Ukraine. There are Christians in Russia. And so as we pray and as we think about these issues, we should always be careful to pray for the church that is being persecuted, the church that is suffering because of political difficulties in those areas. And we've tried to do that here. We pray for those nations regularly over the last few weeks especially, and just encourage all Christians to do that.
Yeah, I'm speaking with Tom Askell. You can follow him on X at Tom Askell, A-S-C-O-L. And it's such an incredibly important reminder. And, you know, and it reminds me of, you know, those who were praying for the United States under, you know, I mean, certainly we could say, you know, the persecution of Christians wasn't quite to the level of, you know, Iran and some of these other countries. But when you look at the Christians that were persecuted genuinely under the Biden regime and some of these who, you know, were arrested just for their faith, for praying outside of abortion clinics, for exercising their faith, and were literally in chains here in America, it's a shocking view when we who have grown up understanding religious freedom and the freedom to exercise our faith in our communities in the public square. I think it was such a shocking wake-up call that we tend to, as Americans, think of, well, you know, here in America, that could never happen. And persecution only happens in, you know, some of these countries that don't adhere faithfully to the Judeo-Christian worldview. But with that, what should Christians be paying attention to so that we don't see that type of persecution that you're describing for the church in the Middle East ever be here in America?
Yeah, well, there are two or three things that come to mind immediately. One, I think, fundamentally, is we need to understand what the Bible says about persecution, because oftentimes we'll say, well, there's no persecution here because nobody's getting their heads taken off their shoulders. Well, certainly nobody's being beheaded for being a Christian in America. But when Jesus is giving us the Beatitudes, he says, you know, we're blessed when others revile and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. So persecution has, it's a continuum. There's extreme forms, and our brothers and sisters in different places in the world, especially the Middle East, are experiencing some of those extremities. But when you're reviled, whenever people are trying to oppress and repress and cut you off from what is normally available to citizens in a republic, well, because you're a Christian, that also is persecution. We're not saying it's the same extremity of persecution, but we should see it and categorize it the way Jesus does. So I think that's number one. But number two is we need to realize what we have in terms of a privilege and an obligation that lays heavily upon me when I think of stewardship. I am a Christian in an American republic. This nation has been bequeathed to us from generations going back to its founding by those who recognize the true and the living God. I don't mean everybody was a Christian at the founding, but the Christian religion was preeminent at the founding, and all of the colonies had religious tests That was a part of our heritage. I'm not suggesting we go back there, but what I'm suggesting is you cannot deny the foundation on which this nation rests. And as a citizen in the United States, my responsibility is greater, I think, in some ways than a citizen in an Islamic republic, because here in the United States, our ultimate authority is not a man, it's a constitution. And who is the true king? You know, who is the final authority? It's we, the people. And so in one sense, I try to teach folks here, we need to think of ourselves as citizen kings. And what does the Bible call kings to do, those who have authority to rule in a geopolitical entity? Well, they are to rule in the fear of God. They are to suppress evil. They are to reward what is good. We, the people, need to insist upon that, calling upon our civil magistrates to do exactly that. The president is the president because of Jesus Christ, who has all authority. And he is, as Romans 13 puts it, God's deacon, God's servant. And so he needs to be instructed on what is good, what is evil, and be encouraged to promote what is good and resist what is evil. And what we're seeing happening, even here in Florida, but certainly in places like Minnesota and Michigan, is the rise of Islam, and the rise of an Islam that has embedded within it a radicalism that's sole purpose is to conquer the United States and to conquer wherever it plants. If we don't open our eyes to see this and recognize it, then I'm afraid Christians will be too passive in thinking, well, let's live and let live. We have this democratic republic, and we have religious liberty, and so they're free to practice their religion. I'm free to practice my religion, and we should not ever speak against anything that is contrary to what the true religion is, because that's just their view. This is just our view. Well, that's not true. Jesus Christ has authority over all nations. He has authority over every authority, and I'm not suggesting taking up the weapons of the world in order to advance the cause of Christ, but we should be unashamed to declare the lordship of Christ over every aspect of this land. And I think as American Christians, we have an opportunity that most Christians throughout history in most places of the world could only dream of. And God help us if we sit by and squander it rather than steward it well for the generations that will follow after us.
Amen. Preach it. And so true. And even though our Constitution forbids legally a religious test, that absolutely does not in any way forbid us as the citizen kings, as you rightly put it, from having our own religious test. And that's where the religious test should be, is in the ballot box. We should be vetting the people in office to ensure that we select and prefer Christians as our leaders, genuine, true Christians who will take that worldview, understand our founding, be unashamed, and move forward in our civic society, applying biblical principles to our government. And in just the last few minutes, with you, Tom Askell, you made a great announcement that Dr. Vadi Bakum is announced as the president of Founders Seminary. So excited about that, and for the two of you in that seminary. And so much of what I see between seminary and law school, seminary teaches theology, law school doesn't teach enough theology, law school teaches the parameters of the legal view that seminary doesn't teach enough. I'd love to see like a law school seminary kind of thing. And so is there any plan for something like that to teach the biblical worldview of government there?
Yeah, there actually is. I mean, our seminary grew out of the Institute of Public Theology, which we are now converting to a four-year Bible college. And the first three majors are business, classical Christian education, and public theology. Within the public theology track, there very much is, there's a whole section on dealing with cultural issues, dealing with the way nations are thought of. We're building that out. But the short answer is yes, God willing, this will be a part of that undergraduate curriculum over the next several years as we get all of those courses of our four-year curriculum built out. Because it is, as you say, it is desperately needed. It's lacking. We're not thinking Christianly about the law. One of the emphases of Founders Ministries has been to teach law and gospel. And in fact, one of the pastors that I serve here with at Grace Baptist Church in Cape Coral has a book coming out on the second use of the law, which has been significantly neglected in the last 100 years of Western evangelicalism. I can say that pretty safely. It probably goes back, which says, you know, God gave us the commandments, the Ten Commandments, the second use of that law is to restrain sin in society. The law can't save anybody. The law convicts individually. That's its first use. The law guides Christians to tell us what's right, what's wrong. Even, you know, after we're converted, it still stands. And the second use is the law restrains evil in society.
We gotta leave it there. But Tom Askell, we'll have you back on with more soon. That's awesome. Preborn's whole mission is to rescue babies from abortion and lead their families to Christ. Last year, Preborn's network of clinics saw 8,900 mothers come to Christ. Please join us in this life-saving mission. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR.